The relationship between God and Israel was really pretty tragic. And here in Jeremiah 2, you have the whole thing played out again. They're absolutely departing from God, and he pleads with them about their earlier relationship and the greatness of his love for them. Verse 2, go and cry in the ears of Jerusalem. You've got to enter into the passion of it. Thus says Yahweh, I remember the kindness of your youth, the love at the time of your marriage, how you went after me in the wilderness. So the whole meeting of God between with Israel in the wilderness is described as him falling in love with them. You see this again in Ezekiel, where again he uses this figure that at Sinai he spread his skirt over them. That was where they consummated the marriage. So he describes himself as in love with them, and also says that they were in love with him. At that time, I remember the kindness of your youth, the love at the time of your marriage, how you went after me in the wilderness. Well, you see, this is imputed righteousness, because that is not really what happened. They left Egypt because of the push factors. They were being beat up, they were dying, they desperately wanted to get out, and yet all the way through, they kept saying, no, actually, I will stay. And no sooner are they in the desert and across the Red Sea than they're saying to Moses, oh, would God we had died in Egypt. You brought us out here to kill us. And in Ezekiel 20, it is labored about four times that they actually carried the idols of Egypt with them through the Red Sea. Acts 7, quoting Amos, makes the point, Stephen makes the point, that they carried with them the tabernacle of Moloch, as well as the tabernacle of Yahweh, and the star of your god Remphan, as well as the poles upon which there were the standards of the tribes. Speaking of God's cherubic presence with them through the cherubim. And so, you see, they were weak from the start. They were not committed to God. They despised Moses and thrust him from them, and in their hearts returned to Egypt. I'm quoting, as I guess you know. They were back in Egypt. They did not want to go with God's program at all. Let us make a captain and return, even when they were at Sinai, golden calf. So how can God here say, I remember the kindness, the chesed, the covenant love of your youth, the love at the time of your marriage, how you went after me in the wilderness? Well, this is imputed righteousness. Love is not, in fact, blind. That is not so. But what it is true to say is that the in love, sort of a status or a period, involves seeing the beloved as wonderful, as in fact more wonderful than they are, sort of exaggerating the image of the beloved. Although the woman may see that the guy she loves is an alcoholic and he's a drug addict and he's this, that and the other and he beats her up and all that, yet yeah, you know, she sees that. She's not totally blind. She sees it, but she remains in love and seeing all the wonderful characteristics of this guy. And God comes over here and in Ezekiel as in love, as if he fell in love with Israel. Now, this is what it meant for God to enter covenant relationship with his people, to take a wife unto himself, as it were. And this same love and this same desire to impute righteousness is counted to us. And yet, it is not simply so that, yeah, well, okay, God counts me righteous, so I'm good to go, I can do what I want, I don't have to be faithful to him. No, this is the whole tragedy of it all. It's the tragedy of the relationship of Hosea with Gomer, the prostitute and the prophet, and that unlikely relationship with Hosea loving her to the end and her being unfaithful and abusive to him to the end. This was God and Israel. And so he says in verse 11, has a nation changed its gods, which really are no gods, but my people have changed their glory, their God, Yahweh, for that which does not profit. And they did. They changed their glory into the similitude of an ox, the golden calf, Psalm 106 says. And, of course, generally, the pagan nations around them didn't change their gods. They had a national god, a traditional god, and they were faithful to that God and very proud of him. He was their glory. But if they were overrun by somebody else, well, they had to accept the gods of their conquerors. But Judah were perverse. They kept on changing their gods, and that's why they're described in Hosea and Ezekiel as a sexually addicted woman, ever seeking new partners, even paying men to sleep with her. And in that sense, they were worse than the other nations, and God is lamenting this and feeling this. He says in verse 13, "My people committed two evils. They forsook me," that's number one, the spring of living waters, and number two, they cut them out cisterns, broken cisterns that can hold no water. Why talk about cisterns and water when the idea is you forsook me and you went to the idols? Well, I think the idea is that Baal was thought to be the rain god who gave fertility and rain, which is critically important in the climate of Palestine. So they considered that there was a better chance of getting rain out of Baal than there was out of Yahweh. And so God feels the full extent of their sin. You did two evils. One, you forsook me, who is the source of living water. Number two, you cut out cisterns that can hold no water. So God has such sensitivity to his people that he analyzes all the implications and ramifications of their sin. It must be so hard to be God with the ability to do that and yet also with this burning grace and love. And he says, verse 21, "I planted you a noble vine, a right seed. How then have you turned into the degenerate branches of a foreign vine to me?" Same argument in Isaiah 5, where God says, "I made you the best vineyard," and the vineyard of the Lord of hosts, we're told, was his people. "I fenced you in, I dug up the ground, I removed all the rocks and stones out of it. I absolutely made you the best vineyard. How then did you bring forth wild grapes? You should have brought forth the best grapes." In other words, God gave his people the optimal environment for being fruitful. And it's the same here. "I planted you a noble vine, a right seed. So how are you now like a degenerate wild vine?" And so it is with us. God actually does provide us with the optimal spiritual environment to be fruitful because he wants us to bring forth fruit, the fruit of the Spirit. And we often complain, though, that, "Ah, if only I lived in another country, then I'd be more spiritual. If I lived nearer to a church that believes as I do and I could go there regularly, oh, I'd be more spiritual. If only," some people would say, "I were married to someone else. If only I had better health. If only I had more money, you see, I could serve God better." No, I'm not saying that you shouldn't try to make optimal decisions. You know, if you're persecuted in one city, Jesus says, flee to another and get out of seriously abusive situations. But the point is that we have been given an environment that is optimal. That is a very hard thing to believe, but it is true. And it's sort of logical, really, because God wants us to be fruitful. And God struggles with this. "How? How have you turned into a degenerate branch of a foreign vine to me?" Like he says also in Isaiah 5, "How is it that you brought forth wild grapes when it should have been the best quality grapes? How? How can this be?" So often God says that. You know, he sends his servants to get the fruit of the vineyard. They beat one stone another. And he says in the parable, "I will send my son. Surely they will reverence my son. And they don't, they kill him." And often the prophets, God says this, "How is it? I thought you would have been my proud sons in whom I could have been proud. But you weren't. You turned away from me. How is this?" Now, you can understand that as simply anthropomorphism. That is, God using human language just to sort of make a point kind of thing that we might understand. But I have a bit of a problem with that, because if it's all anthropomorphism, then it would mean that actually there is no basis for reality in it. God doesn't really feel like that. He just says that. And I don't like that idea, really. I think that although God does know all things and can know the future, and God can do all things, he is omnipotent and omniscient, he can, as it were, limit that omnipotence and omniscience in order to enter into real relationship with us, in order, as it were, to have our perspective on time. He can do that so that it really does feel like this. He is in that sense of shock and disappointment. And it is tragic that Israel were like this with him. And so the question is with us, well, we are his new wife, if you like. Are we going to be faithful? Are we going to be the same miserable, low-life sort of flirty woman that Israel were? Or are we going to be, for all our weakness and as we see it, our unattractiveness, are we going to be better? Are we going to at least be solidly faithful? That here I am, and I'm not that great, but I'm not a beauty, but here I am, and I'm solidly behind you, and I think you're great, and I worship you. That should be our attitude to him. And I think the failure and the tragedy of the failure of Israel and the pain to God that you keep on reading in a passage like this in Jeremiah 2 is what underlines that and helps us to see that that is indeed how we swear and vow ourselves to be.